Welcome to the Loving Wellness Podcast, your compass to embracing a holistic approach to health, one that extends love not only to your body and spirit, but also ripples outward to those around you. I'm your host, Ava Nori, a registered dietitian and your wellness BFF. Together, we'll dive deep into all the ways you can practice loving wellness in your own life and tap into the healthiest, happiest, most aligned version of yourself through both solo episodes and conversations with experts in many fields. Let's get into the show. Hello, hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Loving Wellness Podcast. Welcome if you're new here. I am so excited you're here today because this guest episode is one that I've just been so excited to release ever since I had this conversation. I am talking to Dr. Ryan Monahan today, and Dr. Ryan is a doctor of acupuncture and oriental medicine, and he's also a functional medicine practitioner. And Dr. Ryan practices in a very similar way to me, which is why I was so excited to have him on the show. If you're new to integrative and functional medicine, then this episode might ruffle some feathers, make you think about the things that you've been taught about health and wellness as we know it today. And if you're not new to this space, we go deep on a lot of different topics in this episode that you might have known about before, but you might not have known to this extent. So I think there's something in this episode for everyone. We cover so many different things, like I said. We talk about why all dis-ease and imbalances in the body usually stem from the gut and how we can optimize gut health through functional medicine approaches. We talk about HPA axis dysregulation, which is just a fancy way to say our stress response system and how it's been so dysregulated by the modern society we're living in and why our stress response needs so much support these days. We talk about addressing stressors through diet and lifestyle and other approaches. We talk about a really important topic, which is why the city that you live in makes a bigger impact on your health than you may think. Talk about gluten-free diets and whether or not you should go gluten-free. And speaking of diets and what kind of foods you should be consuming, we really dive deep on what an ideal diet looks like for optimal nutrient status, the most nutrient-dense foods in the world, what some common nutrient deficiencies that Dr. Ryan sees in practice are and how to solve them, and then root causes of lots of different imbalances in the body, including hormone imbalances, thyroid disorders, and detoxification issues. We also talk about how to properly detoxify the body and how to open up drainage pathways in order to do so, which a lot of people don't know about. And I think it's a really important part of this conversation because I see so many people going on detoxes and cleanses, yet they're not doing the correct things before they're going on these protocols in order to actually help their body detoxify. And then we also cover the issues with hormonal birth control. This is a really important conversation that I think if you're on birth control, if you're considering going on it or going off of it, you gotta hear. And Dr. Ryan offers a really amazing perspective on this issue. I completely agree with his thoughts on it, if you were wondering. And I think that it's just a really important conversation that needs to be had more often in our society. So that was definitely one of my favorite parts of the episode. But truly, the entire thing is just so informative. Dr. Ryan offers such a brilliant perspective, and I think you're really going to love him and all the information that he shares in this episode. So I will let you listen to that right now. But before I do, just a reminder to give the show a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts if you haven't already. This is what helps get the show into the ears of as many people as possible. And if you want more holistic wellness content from me and to just get more updates about the show and different episodes coming out, make sure to give me a follow on Instagram at Ava Nori Wellness. And make sure to give Dr. Ryan a follow as well. He shares lots of brilliant information in the integrative and functional medicine space over on Instagram. And his website is also in the show notes below. Okay, without further ado, here is my episode with Dr. Ryan Monahan. Enjoy and let us know what you think over on Instagram. Well, thank you so much for being on the Loving Wellness Podcast, Dr. Ryan. I'm so excited to chat with you today about all things functional and Eastern medicine and just health and wellness in general. I gave you a little bit of a recording or an intro in this recording before, but
before we dive into everything together, I would love to just kind of get to know a little bit more about you and your story and how you got into all this. Because I find that people in our field usually had some sort of healing journey of their own or something that got them into this work personally. So if you don't mind sharing that, I would love to hear.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And I find the same thing as well, like going through school, all the people I were around in that education process were there for the same reason. We all had something happen to us in our life, in our health, that became the central focus of us trying to heal ourselves. And I was no exception. Like 2007, I was living in San Francisco, and I didn't know it at the time, but in hindsight, it turns out I was living in a black mold apartment. And I was really ill. I got really ill really fast. Like, my health just deteriorated rapidly. Like, you know, chronic fatigue and respiratory issues and brain fog and digestive issues and just not doing well. And I was seeing my conventional doctor, and they'd give me like Prilosec and antibiotics, and I was getting sick all the time and sicker. And it's like, this is not working. I'm not going to make it if I don't figure something out. And somebody referred me to a functional medicine doctor, and another person referred me to an acupuncturist. And I started seeing both of these people, and they helped me recover significantly in about 6 months. And I was pretty blown away at how effective it was, and decided this was something I was really interested in, and started researching it on my own and studying and reading books. And then I was like, I think I have to go back to school for this, because I think this is way more important than what I am doing. And yeah, it's been an education ever since. Like, you never stop learning once you start this area, health and wellness. There's so much, it's endless. There's new stuff every day. And especially working with patients, that's really when you start learning, I found. Like, you learn a lot of like standard stuff in school that's very important and foundational, but patients are very complex. And when you start working with them individually, your learning goes into hyperdrive, because you have to figure stuff out, you know, and it's complicated.
I couldn't agree more with that. I feel like it's always something new I'm researching or looking up, because you can't learn it all in school. And I think one thing I learned in school, or just my additional functional and integrative medicine training, is that, you know, the gut is usually where a lot of this starts, because optimal digestion really is so essential and the foundation of our health. So I kind of want to start there with you. Thank you for sharing your story. I feel like that gives a lot of context to why you got into this work. But just to get into the work itself, I personally find that people rarely have optimal digestion. Like, there's always something going on with the gut. And it's no surprise, given the way that we live our lives today in this modern society. And that becomes the root of so many diseases and imbalances in the body. So just from your perspective, what do you think is going on? Like, why are we seeing so much dysbiosis, so much intestinal hyperpermeability, which for people listening is what you probably have heard as leaky gut, SIBO, like H. pylori, all these things going on? Why all these digestive imbalances?
Yeah, you're spot on. Everybody's got a gut issue, and if they don't know it, I work with a lot of patients. And I, you know, tell them we're going to look at, you know, some gut health testing. And they're like, oh, we don't have to do that. My digestion's fine. And I'm like, definitely not fine. a lot of people think just because, you know, they eat food and don't feel nauseous immediately after, that means their digestion's fine. But, you know, to your point, digestion really is the foundation of health. And it feeds every other system in the body. And if your digestion is struggling, maybe you'll have digestive issues that are obvious and apparent, but maybe they'll express in different ways. There's the gut-brain axis, so any cognitive issues could be gut issues. I was just about to list all the gut axes, but there's too many. There's a gut-lung axis, a gut-eye axis, a gut-liver axis. Like, the gut is connected to every, you know, vital organ. So all that is to say, if you have any health issue at all, there's likely a gut issue in conjunction. So yeah, you have to look at that. And to why does everybody have gut issues? That's such a long answer, but, you know, let's dig into it a little. First of all, I ask patients, have you ever taken an antibiotic in your life? It's usually 100% that people have taken an antibiotic, right? And more likely they've taken several or dozens. I mean, I know some patients that their doctor prescribing them an antibiotic before sex every time to prevent UTIs. So every time they have sex, they take an antibiotic.
Wow.
It's just reckless, right? That's not the purpose of an antibiotic. Antibiotic at this point should be used for life-threatening situations where you'll die if you don't take it. There are alternatives, safe, healthy, balanced alternatives that you can use instead of an antibiotic in like a UTI or a lot of other situations. So you're seeing antibiotic resistant bacteria come in now, and that's very dangerous. So antibiotic use is a part of it. If you were C-section versus vaginal birth, that can start you off with a depleted microbiome. And, C-section is kind of a relatively new thing, maybe 100 years old. And then you have to think in terms of generations, right? So it's not just, why do you have a gut that is weak? It could be because over the past 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 generations as a human species, we've been living in a world that is becoming more and more toxic and polluted, and there's less, nutrient density of the food we're eating, but the air quality is worse, the soil's worse. We're exposed to far more chemicals than we ever have been. All of this stuff impacts the microbiome and the gut. So it's really just all the stuff stacking on top of each other. And your body can compensate for a little bit of this and a little bit of that. But it's when it all comes together and when it's been, stacking for generations, eventually it reaches a breaking point. And we're kind of there, we're kind of at that point where people have a lot of chronic diseases, and it's not really because they did anything wrong. It's just the nature of the world we're living in at this point. So I do find most people need to really go hard at addressing their gut and healing, whatever imbalances we find through testing.
Yeah, I think a lot of people listening might be like, I don't know, happy to hear that it's not their fault. I think it's a lot of it, like you said, is built into our environment, and that might be a good thing for a lot of people because they're like, okay, it's not my fault. I didn't do anything wrong. But a lot of people might also get a little frightened by that notion. So if someone's listening and they're like, okay, I'm basically screwed and I didn't even have to try, what do I do to heal my gut? And I know you mentioned testing, and I'm a big fan of stool testing. I like the GI map, but what is kind of your approach to optimizing gut health?
Yeah, I'm the same. I love lab work. I do everything through that lens, and it just quantifies exactly what we need to focus on. And, functional lab work is quite advanced compared to the conventional stuff. If you go in for your annual physical with a primary care physician and, allopathic medicine, they're going to run like a CBC and metabolic panel. Those are some basic blood markers. And most of the time they'll come back normal and they'll say everything looks fine, but you're like, but I don't feel fine. And that's not really serving people anymore. So a lot of patients I work with have gone through that traditional approach and it hasn't gotten them anywhere. Maybe they went to a GI doc and got a colonoscopy or an endoscopy and they look at the organ with a scope and they're like, it looks fine. Okay. But maybe it's not functioning fine. And that's where functional medicine comes in. We want to look at the function. And GMF's a really good test. I personally use Genova GIFX more so, but they're both good. It tells us so much, metabolic activity, inflammation, maldigestion, malabsorption, dysbiosis, infections, parasites, bacteria, H. pylori, leaky gut. Like there's so many things it looks at, hundreds of markers. And then I tack on a SIBO breath test, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And just if you want to just look at the gut, those are kind of the two tests I start with. And you can make a lot of headway there. And then I treat with natural compounds, herbs, botanicals, vitamins, minerals, amino acids, fatty acids, things that help heal the body, not just suppress symptoms like a drug. So you can, if you want to be proactive, do these types of things to heal your gut from maybe decades of, suffering. And if you follow a healthy lifestyle after that, you should be in good shape for a long time. And if something else comes up at some point, we just, kind of go through the process again and, you can heal it again. I've healed my gut several times. It's not like once you heal your gut, you're immune to anything bad ever happening. But there are safe, balanced ways to approach this rather than just taking an antibiotic or anti-inflammatory or steroid.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said that because I've also healed my gut multiple times. And it's not like a one-time thing. It's a journey, as wellness always is. So I don't think there's ever a point where you're going to have perfect gut health 100% of the time. It's just not realistic in this day and age. But I think that it's awesome that there's things that we can do. And functional medicine has your back normally when it comes to gut things. But one thing I've been really interested in lately is the HPA axis and just dysregulation of the HPA axis. It's something I've been coming back to a lot with thyroid and gut, and I don't think it's talked about enough. So I really wanted to open this conversation with you today because I saw in your post on gut and hormones that you talked about the HPA axis and why it's so dysregulated in so many of us. So if you could just kind of go into what even the HPA axis is, because I think a lot of people listening probably don't know how we get to this dysregulated state and why that's causing these imbalances in the body, not just in the gut, but so many other parts of the body.
Yeah, HPA stands for hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. So it's this connection from the hypothalamus in your brain to the pituitary gland to your adrenals, which sit atop the kidneys. And it's kind of a fancy way of talking about the stress response in the body. So if your body perceives stress, whether that's emotional stress or an environmental stressor like pollutants or like a pathogenic stressor like an infection, things like that, your body's going to respond in different ways hormonally and release certain compounds to compensate. So your HPA axis has a lot to do with your perception of the world and stressors in it. And most people are experiencing a really high level of stress these days, both from the obvious thing. You know, when we say the word stress, people think of like stuck in traffic or a long day at work or a fight with your spouse or something like that. And that's like an emotional stress, but there's physiological stressors, like, you know, causing oxidative stress and inflammation in the body that are really at the root of all the chronic disease in this day and age. And so most people are overloaded with that type of stress in their body, and they don't have any bandwidth left to deal with anything else. And then the state of the world, you know, there's a lot of things to be stressed out about, right? So yes. Like people are just at a breaking point, and you know, it's not always the easiest thing to change the stressors in your world around you or in the world at large. But you can address a lot of the physiological stressors internally through like these labs and, you know, supplemental protocols, changes to diet. I do a lot of lifestyle recommendations. Like I give a handout to every patient I work with called How to Manage Your Stress. And it keeps growing, but right now it's like 23 pages and it's got dozens and dozens of, you know, practices and all these things that you can consider to help mitigate and modulate stress in your life. And people, especially in America, I think kind of wear stress as a badge of honor. You know, it's like I work hard, play hard, no pain, no gain. And like, if you're not hustling, this, that, the other. So really it's like the idea is to be more in a parasympathetic state, right? Not a sympathetic state. So instead of fight or flight, more like rest and digest. And just like people need to rest and slow down. So for HPA access, there's a lot of practices to de-stress, whether that's yoga or meditation or stretching or time spent in nature or hiking or adaptogenic herbs, right? Like, you know, ginseng and reishi and cordyceps and ashwagandha, like all these things help, CBD actually, all these things help modulate that HPA axis and kind of downregulate things and calm you down and balance your cortisol levels and your adrenal responses and all of that. So that's honestly the hardest thing to treat, because stress, you can't just take, you know, one supplement and all the stress in your life goes away. Like I said, adaptogen herbs can help for sure on a physiological level, but the hardest part is making the changes in your life that are stressing you out. And that gets pretty big picture. You know, that may be ending a relationship, whether it's romantic or personal, friendship, you know, maybe there's a family member, you know, like you'll have to create strong boundaries. You may be stressed out by the city you're living in, so you have to move, or maybe, you know, the neighborhood. So that's another big change, like moving, changing relationships, looking hard at yourself and seeing what changes you have to make. Maybe there's history, emotional trauma, or physical abuse. Like there's a lot of stuff to tap into. And, you know, so I do provide a lot of resources to my patients on paths they can pursue to dig into that stuff. But there's no quick fix there. That's like usually months or years of work to really start to regulate that at a deep level.
I completely agree. I think even personally, in my own experience with trying to regulate stress, that's been the hardest part of my own health journey. And a big change recently I made for my health, mostly, but for other reasons, of course, it's never just one reason. But I moved, like I was telling you earlier, from New York back to California because my body just could not handle living in that city. It just was, it was so inflamed. I was experiencing so many symptoms that I wasn't used to experiencing, and I was doing everything else the same, essentially. And just from moving back, I mean, I feel like it's like night and day. So I'm sharing this for people to hear that sometimes you do have to make those kind of big life decisions for your health. And it might not be what you always want it to be or the way you want it to look, but it can be the thing that moves the needle the most and makes the biggest difference in your health.
I completely agree. And I lived in New York too. And I lived in Brooklyn and Manhattan. And I was like, not the place for me.
Yeah.
I need nature and sunshine and space and the ocean and the beach and hiking and all that stuff. And so LA was my compromise because it's got like the whole city side, but then it has the nature side. And yeah, New York is, some people love it and it's just, that's their home. And that's great. If you thrive there, that's wonderful. But yeah, city living, especially a place like New York, is intense. Yeah. So getting out of that kind of rat race, if you feel like you're stuck in it and you know, withering and suffering and being crushed by it, make a change. Yeah, be bold. You know, it's hard, but sometimes you have to make big changes to get big changes.
I love that. I completely agree with that. And speaking of stress and HPA axis dysregulation, I kind of wanted to talk about thyroid health with you, because that is something I see as a huge root cause for thyroid disorders. And it's something I've been seeing a lot. Like, I feel like everyone has hypothyroidism these days, and that just wasn't the case years ago. So what are your thoughts on the root causes of thyroid disorders, aside from, we can talk about HPA axis even more and how it relates to thyroid, but why do you think we're seeing so much more of that? And what are some ways that we can start to support our thyroid? And if people aren't experiencing thyroid disorders, how can they prevent those things and take care of their thyroid?
Yeah, well, so the thyroid is related to that HPA axis, certainly. So stress is a big part of it. But then there's also the gut thyroid axis too. And there's a lot of connection between your gut health and your thyroid health. So people come to me with a thyroid issue, like either they've self-diagnosed or they've seen their primary care and, you know, their TSH is out of range or something like that. And they're like, want to work on their thyroid. And so people are used to going to the conventional doctor and be like, I have a thyroid problem. They like give them levothyroxine or some thyroid drug. And they're like, there you go, we're working on your thyroid. So people come to me and they're like very confused because they're like, let's run a stool test and look at your gut, you know? And they're like, but that's not my thyroid. And I'm like, I know, but it's very connected. So yeah, you have to realize that, you know, holistic medicine looks at all systems of the body because the body is one big unit really functioning together. And everything's interdependent. And the thyroid is kind of a really downstream marker for upstream imbalances. And so I look at the gut, you know, there's about 20% of your T3 reservoir is in the gut. So, you know, there's one aspect, but then the thyroid, really its function, like most parts of your body, are dependent on key nutrients, you know, selenium, iodine, zinc, vitamin A, vitamin D, several other nutrients. And if you are deficient in one or several or all of those nutrients, your thyroid just doesn't have the resources to function as it should. And I run micronutrient testing on every patient I work with, and 100% of people are deficient in multiple nutrients. Nobody is walking around with complete repletion of nutrients, right? And nutrients aren't just like things that it would be nice to have if you could. They're required for your body to function. The second you're at a deficit, something's going wrong in your body somewhere. And that shows up differently for different people. So, you know, some patients, it's as simple as addressing a selenium and a zinc deficiency, and suddenly their thyroid works. Like, that's really simple if you just know how to do it, right? And then where do your nutrients come from? We don't want to just give you supplements. Like, we'll do that to fix things in the short term. But long term, they come from eating really healthy food that are nutrient-dense foods, right? Like meat, fish, vegetables, fruit, nuts, and seeds. Organ meats, shellfish, things like that. And then having a functioning digestion that can break down and absorb those foods and nutrients. So it's not just what you eat, it's what you absorb, right? So you have to fix the gut so it works at a high level. You have to eat really healthy, nutrient-dense food to get everything out of it. And at that point, you see a lot of improvement. And then just as a PSA, anyone with a thyroid issue should never eat gluten again in their entire life, because there's this thing called molecular mimicry where proteins and gluten mimic or look the same as proteins in the thyroid. And so if you have, you mentioned intestinal hyperpermeability before, aka leaky gut. If you have a gluten intolerance and you have leaky gut, little pieces of gluten proteins seep through your intestinal wall into your bloodstream. And then your immune system gets activated and it says foreign invader, red alert. And it marks these things with antibodies and it kills anything that looks like gluten in the body. And unfortunately, it's not very specific. And because parts of your thyroid look like parts of gluten, your own body starts attacking your thyroid. And that's like Hashimoto's, right? It's like an autoimmune disease where your body is attacking your thyroid. So if you have a thyroid issue, the first thing you should do is go gluten-free. And I mean 100% gluten-free, not just like I try to avoid gluten, but I have it on cheat days or once in a while. You have to be 100% gluten-free. There's a great study done on some thyroid patients where they looked at gluten and the immune response in them. And it actually took for some of these patients up to 6 months after a single gluten exposure for the immune system inflammation to turn off and settle down. So that means you have to be gluten-free for 6 months before you can be sure that the immune system is no longer attacking your thyroid.
Thank you for sharing that, because I mean, when I talk to people with thyroid disorders, I also usually put them on a gluten-free diet because it's just, it's that important, like you were saying. And there's also gluten cross-reactives, which we could maybe get into, but like it's really important to be careful about it because a lot of things also have gluten that you might not know about. And then you're kind of in that 6 month process again, like you're saying, and people won't find relief until they're kind of 100% about it. Like if you're going to do an experiment, do you want to do it 90% or 80%? Or are you going to put your all into it and do 100% of it?
Exactly. And some people will do that. They'll be like, I've met with so many patients that I went gluten-free for a week or a month or 2 months and it didn't do anything. Not good enough. Has to be 6 months based on the clinical study that I just referred to. And you have to be truly gluten-free. So like you just said, gluten is in a lot of stuff that people don't realize. And then there are gluten cross-reactives, like you mentioned. So that means things that don't even have gluten, but the body views it as gluten and it has the same response to it as gluten. So there's a Cyrex Array 4 test that you can look at cross-reactive foods, grains, pseudo-grains, dairy, eggs, soy, things like that. Even though they don't have gluten, they can act the same way that gluten does in your body in terms of the destructive nature. So yeah, you may take out all the gluten effectively, but then it could be sorghum or amaranth or something like quinoa. All of those could be causing the same problem. So either take all those foods out to start with, which is what I do with my patients, or run that test and see what you definitely have to take out.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier, you know, kind of having the foundations in place, especially with nutrient repletion. And that's something I wanted to talk about with you as well, because I know you're big on beef liver, organ meats, and shellfish, these really high nutrient dense foods. And I, in the past, was vegan for a very long time. And I know a lot of people listening to this might have, you know, cut certain foods out or not really focused on animal protein. So can you kind of speak to that and why it's so important to include things like not just organ meats, but just even muscle meats and animal protein in the diet for true nutrient repletion? And what are your experiences, if you have any, with like vegan patients, if anything, that you've seen across the board in them? And do you think you can be healthy on a vegan diet too?
So all good questions. So
I know I just threw a lot at you.
Yeah. If I don't hit them, any of them, remind me and I will. But those are all good questions. So when I started my health journey, I did what I see so many people doing who are starting health journeys still. I did all the things that in pop culture are trendy health things to do. I did juice cleanses. I did the Master Cleanse. I went vegetarian and then I went vegan. I did raw diets. You know, I did all these things that are, for some reason, the first thing when somebody decides to be healthy, those are the first things people do in my experience. Maybe that's changing now with like more awareness, but I don't know. I still talk to a lot of people that start there, and I started there too, and it didn't help. I got worse. And the reason for the importance of animal proteins and then really high density foods like organ meats and shellfish, my perspective is most people are suffering from a high level of nutrient deficiencies that inhibit their body from doing everything it has to do on a daily basis. So your goal, the food conversation is so polarized, and I think it's almost silly because to me it's so simple. Just eat the most nutrient-dense food. that's why we eat food. We eat food for nutrients. Like, that's so simple to me. And so you can look on the USDA at nutrient density and lists of all the vitamins and minerals in every food, right? And people have done this. And then you can categorize the most nutrient-dense food down to the least nutrient-dense food. And the most nutrient-dense food are organ meats, like liver especially is like number one, but like any organ meat, followed by things like shellfish, like clams, mussels, oysters, things like that. And then, you know, muscle meats, things like that, vegetables, like these are the most nutrient-dense foods. So just eat those. If you can eat as little food as possible with the most nutrients, that's the best, because you're using the least amount of digestive energy and getting the most reward, the most nutrients. And so the nutrients then supply you with everything your body needs to function at a high level. Okay, so can you be healthy as a vegan? I always use this example. I have a great patient I've worked with for years, and she's a vegan, and she's really healthy, and she's had two kids. She's in her 40s, and she looks like she's 28. And I'm always impressed. I'm like, I kind of hold her as the golden example of a vegan who's healthy. And so I was like, I want to run your labs and just see where you're at. And we've run a lot of her labs, and things are good. Like, there are things to tweak and improve, of course, like anybody, but for the most part, she was really in pretty good shape. And then I was really surprised by all that. And then she did tell me after we ran the labs that she does eat oysters like 2 or 3 times a month, and which is technically not vegan, right? And I'm not trying to like pass judgment on whether she's a true vegan or not. I'm just highlighting she did have oysters in her diet at least 2 or 3 times a month, I think she said. And so oysters being one of the most nutrient dense foods, we're probably compensating for those key nutrients that you are really challenging to get on a purely vegan diet. And so she was almost taking this multivitamin in the form of an oyster for the things that vegans won't typically get, you know? I was like, I think that's it. So the ideal diet from a nutrient density perspective, and most people won't follow this, but would be to just eat organ meats, you know, the shellfish I listed, and vegetables, like tons of plants, like tons of vegetables. That would be, from a nutrient density perspective, the most healthy diet you could consume. Short of that, like a paleo is more amenable to many people. So like meat, fish, vegetables, fruit, nuts, and seeds. And I think there's probably a question I didn't answer out of those. Do you remember? Or was that everything?
I think that was it. I was just more curious about like what nutrient deficiencies you see in vegans. But you kind of, I mean, if you're having oysters, then maybe you're not seeing those deficiencies. But, you know, I would always recommend a B12 supplement. If someone is really adamant about being vegan, B12 is really important. I mean, honestly, a B complex is what I recommend. But what else do you see people being very deficient in? I think vitamin A is also a big one. Like if you have some cod liver oil, that'd be great too.
Those are all correct. Iron as well, selenium, zinc, some of the B vitamins like B12, especially vitamin A. So that's the thing, is like vitamin A in the retinol form is the bioactive form of vitamin A that our body uses. So beta carotene is what vegans use to get their vitamin A, quote unquote. But I think it's about 45% of the population doesn't have a key enzyme that converts beta carotene to the bioactive form of vitamin A retinol. So if you're in that percentage of people and you're vegan and you're using beta carotene to supply your vitamin A, most of the people will be vitamin A deficient. It just won't happen for you. As hard as you try, it won't happen. So that's a lot of people. Vitamin D, you know, you get from the sun, but also, like you said, is rich in like a cod liver oil and some of the fatty, oily fish. So if you're not eating those, yeah, omegas. So there are kind of workarounds that, you know, some people do for some of this stuff, algaes and things like that. But you have to work pretty hard and you have to be really aware of your deficits and how to compensate for those. And so maybe if you're running a lot of micronutrient testing to make sure you're doing well, you know, every 6 months or so. And you can, you know, if you see you have a specific deficiency, you can really up whatever you're using to take that. It's not to say you can't be healthy and vegan. It's just a lot more work. It's a lot harder. And then by and large, I think within 3 to 5 years of most people being vegan, I won't say most, a good number of people being vegan after 3 to 5 years start to see some key nutrient deficiencies that show up in their health in a way that they see. And that's usually like when somebody comes to me and says, you know, that they've been vegan, but they're coming to me for health issues. It's almost always that they say they've been vegan for 3 to 5 years. It's always in that window. Your body has a reservoir and can withstand that diet for a while. And so people feel really good at first. And they're like, this is great. I feel amazing the first year or something. And often that's because you're going to a diet that is removing a lot of bad stuff. It's not like people are going from a paleo diet, which is what I recommend, to a vegan diet, and like, wow, I feel so much better than I did on paleo. It's they're going from like a standard American type diet with junk food, processed foods, you know, packaged foods, you know, things that aren't good for you. They take that out because it's maybe, you know, they're doing this vegan diet now. And so they're eating, you know, cleaner foods, fresher foods. And so for a while, they feel really good because it's an elimination diet at some point. Yeah, down the road, it's hard to maintain that long term unless you're really, really smart about it.
Yeah. And that's been my experience as well. And for me, I lasted 8 years, and then my body was like, no, we're not doing this anymore.
Impressive.
Yeah. I mean, I was also young when I started, so that also might have something to do with it. But it's good until it isn't good anymore. And then it starts wreaking havoc on the body. And one of the big things that I personally experienced after I was vegan for so long was a hormonal imbalance, like major issues with my hormones, experiencing a lot of symptoms of that, things like acne, and not just a general hormonal imbalance, but things that are very linked to estrogen dominant symptoms like PCOS and endometriosis and, you know, fibroids, like all these things are so common now. And we've reached a point where like hormones are, everyone's trying to balance their hormones, and with good reason. So I know there's a huge link between the gut and hormones. So we could talk a little bit more about that. And maybe you could kind of break down the concept of the estrobilome for us, but also just excess estrogen and these estrogen dominant conditions have a big link with the liver and detoxification. So I'd love to kind of get that conversation started and your thoughts on all of it. I know I just threw a lot of things at you again.
Yeah, no, these are great questions. And those are big concepts that are really important. The estrobilome. So like you have a microbiome, you have this estrobilome in your gut, and that has to do with estrogens and how those are processed through the gut. And, you know, you do clear a lot of old hormones out through your gut. So if you have gut issues, you probably have hormone issues. And again, that's like people come to me and they say, I want to work on my hormones. And I'm like, let's do a stool test. And like, that's not my hormones, you know, like, yeah, but it's so influential in how your hormones function. So there's the estrobilome. But then, you know, your gut makes hormones, first of all. So if your gut has issues, then you're going to have issue making hormones. Your gut clears hormones. So if your gut has issues, you're going to have trouble clearing old hormones, and then they back up in your system and you have hormonal imbalances because you're not getting rid of this old stuff that you need to clear out for the new stuff to make way. Beta-glucuronidase is this, you know, big marbly mouth word for this toxic byproduct of pathogenic bacteria in the gut. They basically release this thing called beta-glucuronidase, and we measure for that in our stool tests, and it'll show you if it's high. And if it's high, that causes a backlog of hormones. It's hard for you to clear hormones out of the gut if you have high levels of beta-glucuronidase. It's also hard to clear toxins if you have a high level of beta-glucuronidase. So, you know, you have to look at the gut for that. But then, like you said, the liver as well. The liver also detoxes and clears hormones. You know, cruciferous vegetables are really good to support this process. So Brussels sprouts, like my favorite vegetable to eat. But the cruciferous vegetable family has many, many options. So eating as many cruciferous vegetables to get the sulforaphane and all of those great compounds that help with estrogen clearance and regulation of hormones. And then again, nutrients. So like most people don't realize people know the liver detoxes, but if you say, okay, how does it detox? They'll just stare at you with a blank face. They don't know how. It uses nutrients. Phase 1 and phase 2 liver detoxification use B vitamins, minerals, amino acids, antioxidants. All of these things are used to detoxify your body, and that includes hormones as well. So if you're nutrient deficient, if you're not eating nutrient dense food, if you don't have enough amino acids from bioavailable proteins, aka like an animal-based diet rather than a vegan diet, you know, if you're not getting the B vitamins, if you're not getting the minerals, antioxidants, all of that stuff, you're not going to be clearing out hormones and detoxing through the liver as well as you could. So yeah, again, it's looking at multiple systems and then addressing like xenoestrogens, of course, you know, in the environment, there's a lot of that going on. If you're taking synthetic hormones, obviously there's going to be issues from that. You know, synthetic hormones, it will cause issues in your body, birth control, things like that. But then, yeah, there's just chemicals, pesticides, herbicides, plastics. All this stuff is, they're endocrine disrupting and they cause hormone imbalances. So we have to, you know, we can run toxic burden testing to see what you're high in. Like I've had patients who, like male patients, for example, who have really low levels of testosterone, and atrazine is this, you know, chemical compound in the environment that can really suppress testosterone levels. So instead of just giving a guy a testosterone cream to artificially boost his testosterone number on a test, you might want to explore, you know, if they have, you know, chemicals in their body suppressing hormones, like just the example I use is atrazine and testosterone. But there's hundreds of these chemicals, if not thousands, that alter hormone balance. So again, you just have to look in a lot of places, turn over a lot of stones, and each person's different. There's not a universal, everyone has high low levels of atrazine that has low testosterone. That's not necessarily the case. It could just be, again, like a zinc deficiency or a lot of different things.
Yeah, there's a few things I want to touch on in what you've said. And one of them is kind of supporting detoxification with nutrients. And I just made a reel the other day about if someone's going to start a detoxification protocol, do a cleanse of some sorts, if they're not having regular bowel movements, then they should definitely consider that before they start. And so could you kind of explain how we can support our drainage pathways, not just bowel movements, but there's a lot of different ways to do so. What are kind of your recommendations before someone starts to support detoxification, whether it is, you know, they're having estrogen dominant symptoms or they're dealing with an overload of toxins from the environment, like atrazine, whatever you are seeing, what can we kind of do before to start supporting that detoxification?
Such an important point. These are great questions and great concepts you're bringing up. I think about all these things every day with everybody I work with, and opening up detox pathways is critical before you do a heavy detox, right? If you want to clear toxins out of the body, but you don't have an open pathway to do so, you're just recycling it through the system and people will feel worse. You'll pull this stuff out of, you know, sequestration. Most toxins are lipophilic, so they're stored in fat, which is why people may have excess weight on their body. And when you start pulling that out of the lipophilic, you know, storage facility into systemic circulation, you better have a place for that to leave the body, or there's just, people will get worse. And that can happen if you don't start with opening drainage pathways, like you said. So you think of detox pathways in the body, you think of like lung, lymph, gut, liver, skin, kidney. All of these are places that your body clears toxins and things it doesn't need. And the gut's a big one. Like every time you have a bowel movement, you're clearing a ton of stuff your body doesn't want anymore. And most people have gut issues. So we always start with the gut. But I never just like start somebody on a detox like day one. You have to fix the gut first. So for me, that's like 2 or 3 months of work. We use the testing to see what needs to be done. And then once the gut's working, you can start to do a heavier detox. And of course, you're going to support, you know, the liver, especially the kidneys, probably. All of these things need to be supported with key nutrients, herbs, botanicals that can help these organs, detox organs, deal with a higher demand, a higher load of clearance. Because when you start giving patients compounds that aggressively chelate or detox toxins from their body, it's more work and you have to support the body. So it's a delicate balance and each patient responds differently. Some people you can hit them hard and they respond well. Some people are super sensitive and you have to go really slow. And this is where it's just a case by case basis and you get feedback from the patient on how they're doing regularly and you make adjustments on the fly. Like I do a lot of mold and mycotoxin work, and that's a major toxin that is, oh my God, it causes every symptom. And when you start clearing that from the body, bringing that to the surface, systemic circulation to clear out, people will get a lot worse if you're not careful and you're not doing it the right way and supporting in the right ways. So yeah, it's a big undertaking. The word detox gets thrown around in common vernacular, and it's actually pretty intense when you're doing a real detox. You know, like a 5-day juice cleanse is not really a detox. Like, the detoxes that I'm working on patients with, we're clearing extremely poisonous compounds from their body. And you have to do it with great intention and very carefully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so important. And like you said, a 5-day juice cleanse is not going to be the deeper detoxification that your body might need. Although it depends on what you're eating before. You could get a little bit done with that, maybe.
I think the reason people feel better from a 5-day juice cleanse, just being a little snarky, is that they're not eating or drinking all the bad stuff they're normally eating. So yeah, I started with juicing too. Like I've done all these things myself. And, you know, juicing is not that great because you're taking out all the fibrous cellulose from the vegetables and fruit. And that is what feeds your healthy bacteria. And then you're just giving it the juice, which is mainly sugars, which feeds bad bacteria in your gut. So I think if people feel better from 5-day juice cleanse, it's that they're taking out all the gluten and the dairy and grains and sugar and processed foods and alcohol and caffeine. They're taking out all the bad stuff. And it's not so much
just like with a vegan diet.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So you mentioned birth control, and this is a conversation I haven't had yet on the podcast, and I thought you'd be the perfect person to chat about this with. So if someone is on birth control or has been on birth control and doesn't really understand why that is a huge deal, can you just kind of educate a little bit around that and why birth control, if someone is on it, they should probably consider getting off?
Wow. How long do we have? I mean, I did.
I know I left the most important topic for last.
No, it's really an important topic. It's just so, it's such a big issue because it's so ingrained in us culturally, that just because something is common doesn't mean it's good for you. Right. So hormonal synthetic birth control is really 60 years old-ish, something like that. It's still kind of new in the history of human existence. And if you're running like a clinical study to test the effects of something, 60 years is not even that long in a sense, right? Like it's a few generations. And you really want to study things like that, I think, more intergenerationally and see, you know, how this is affecting things, you know, decade after decade, generation after generation. So it's a big deal to take synthetic hormones. It's really taking the control away from your body and giving it to an external exogenous drug. And I did a piece on, you know, the side effects of hormonal birth control. I just went through all the medical literature on PubMed related to birth control, and I compiled a list of all the side effects of birth control. And I ended up with a list of like 88 major things, you know, and it's like anything, you know, it disrupts your microbiome, causes a leaky gut, causes nutritional deficiencies, mood disorders, depression, anxiety, fatigue, weight gain, bloating, nausea, dizziness, hair loss, migraines. I could go on and on. Hypothyroidism. Like, I mean, name a symptom, it's been associated with birth control. So you can't necessarily know if your symptoms are unrelated or related until you go off of birth control and see, did your problem go away? I work with a lot of patients who aren't willing to stop their birth control, and that's their choice, of course. But like, we'll go through the process for 6 or 9 or 12 months and run all these tests and treat all these things. And all the things get better. We retest and it looks good, but they still have some problems, right? Maybe some stuff got better, but maybe some stuff didn't. And I've had patients finally agree to go off the birth control, and literally they go off the birth control and maybe a few weeks or a month or two later, that thing that wouldn't go away goes away. So yeah, it's a big deal. And I guess I think a reason people are concerned about not going off is getting pregnant, obviously. So there are options. I recommend the Natural Cycles app, which has been clinically validated to be 96% effective if you do it correctly at preventing pregnancy. And then I also personally recommend neem oil. You can inject 2 milliliters intravaginally 5 minutes before sex, and it acts like a natural spermicide. That's around 96% effective as well if you do it correctly. So if you do those two things, Natural Cycles app plus neem oil, you're really probably not going to get pregnant. And certainly it's equal efficacy to synthetic hormonal birth control without any side effects. In fact, neem oil is very beneficial to the vaginal microbiome. It's very balancing. So actually you'll get some good things out of it. So you don't have to do that. And there's a lot of risk involved with it. A lot of people stay on it because like it helped their skin clear up or you know, other kind of beneficial things. But that's suppression. You're using a drug to suppress a problem. That's not getting to the root. And what I do and what functional medicine tries to do is get to the root of the problem. So if you have skin issues, let's figure out why. It's usually a gut issue or a detox issue. Let's work on that. Because if you suppress it with a drug, great that your skin cleared up, but there's still that dysfunction. There's still detox issues. There's still gut issues, maybe other things. And it will express some other way, like skin issues, just as an example. Any health issue is your body trying to communicate to you, something's wrong, please work on it. And skin issues usually get people motivated because it's like outward and people can see, other people can see it, and people don't want that. So rather than suppressing, you know, your body's messaging, like listen to it and try to figure out what's wrong. If you ignore it and you suppress it, it'll show up in a different way down the road as maybe something worse than just a skin issue.
Yeah. And like you said, there are so many great alternatives now to birth control that it's really not something that people need to be on. And for the skin, getting to the root is the only thing that's going to cause you sustainable results. Because if you're on birth control for your skin, you're going to eventually get off. If you want to get pregnant, the issues are most likely going to come back if you're not dealing with the root cause, like the detoxification or whatever the gut imbalance is. And I think that, you know, I use Natural Cycles. I love it. And I have never been on hormonal birth control because just intuitively, it never felt right to put hormones into my body. But I did have the copper IUD for a bit. And I think a lot of people listening might be like, well, why isn't Dr. Ryan suggesting to go on the copper IUD instead of hormonal birth control? Like, that isn't the only non-hormonal form that I can get at my doctor. It's easy. It stays in for 10 years. Like, all these pros, the copper IUD. And I can get into my experience with it. It wasn't a good one. I ended up getting it out a couple years later. But can you just kind of speak to why the copper IUD might not also be the best option, even though it doesn't have synthetic hormones added into your body?
Yeah, it's interesting. And a lot of people, it's kind of been billed as like a non-hormonal safe approach to birth control. And it's kind of like tricky marketing, in my opinion. So the copper IUD is a piece of plastic, a T-shaped piece of plastic that has a copper coil wrapped around it. So they're inserting a piece of plastic into your reproductive organ, which isn't great to start with, right? We're trying to avoid plastics just like as Tupperware for our food, but then we're putting a piece of plastic inside of your reproductive organ. So that's not great. But then it's true that it doesn't have synthetic hormonal drugs on it or in it, but copper itself is the active component here. And it's actually emitting copper ions that influence and block hormones. So while it's not releasing hormones, it's releasing copper ions that influence hormones. So it is influencing your hormones. And it's kind of the same thing in a sense, right? You're altering your hormones in a foreign way, you know, that's unnatural to your body, with a piece of plastic, really, that's inside your reproductive organ. So in addition to that, it can cause a lot of, you know, bleeding for women, and that could lead to anemia in some cases. It can cause a lot of pain and disruption. When you have it out, they can do damage to the lining of the, you know, the uterus. And it's just not really as safe and benign as it's made out to be. You can have copper toxicity in some cases. It, you know, the copper ions can release too much into your body, and copper toxicity can take place. And people may not know that that's what it's from until they get the copper IUD removed, and then the copper levels return to normal. So symptoms of that may be things like headache, fever, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, black stool, abdominal cramping, jaundice, fainting, anxiety, irritability, difficulty paying attention, depression, sadness, mood imbalances. So like, that's a lot of stuff that people may not associate with their copper IUD. They may think it's a million other things. And so that's where those patients who I worked with, like I've worked with patients where they, you know, kept the copper IUD in, and it wasn't until they took it out that some of those things I just listed got better. Can be associated with pelvic inflammatory disease, PID, which can show up as like pain during sex or fatigue, abnormal vaginal discharge, uterine bleeding after or during sex, bleeding between periods, fever and chills. It's not totally harmless. Some people don't have issues with it, but some people do. So it's important to be aware of that, because I don't think many people are given that type of information when they're, you know, when they have a copper IUD implanted.
Completely. I think people think it's the best option if they're aware of the harms that hormonal birth control can cause. It's kind of seen as this perfect alternative. But like you said, I personally experienced so much pain and so much bleeding and just so much inflammation. And I think it's important to kind of note that copper is inflammatory, especially when the ions are released. It's not bound by ceruloplasmin, the enzyme or protein that copper should be bound by in the body to kind of perform its action. So it can be very inflammatory, and that's definitely what I experienced, and that's why I got it taken out. But like you said, some people might not be experiencing that, and you should always, as I say, like check in with your body, check in with what works for you and with everything we talked about today. If something, you know, doesn't feel good intuitively, check it out for yourself. You don't have to listen to everything that you're hearing, but I just think it's important to educate and talk about these things and bring light to a lot of things that people might not be aware of. So thank you for sharing so much about so many different topics. I know we went all over the place, but I think this is going to be really helpful for people and anyone on their healing journey, wherever they're at. And before we end today, I have a few rapid fire questions I like to ask everyone if you have time.
Cool. I do. Let's do it.
Okay. Amazing. So the first one is, what is your favorite fruit?
I don't eat fruit.
I thought you were going to say.
Yeah. Full disclosure, just because it's kind of sugary, but I love fruit. I actually love sugar. I have total sweet tooth, and I'm a sugar addict if I eat it, but if I don't eat it, I'm okay. So I don't eat fruit because it makes me want sugar.
Interesting.
But to answer that, because I love fruit, it's like guava, passion fruit, pomegranate. I guess those are a few that come to mind first.
Okay, so you're a tropical fruit guy, mostly.
I know. I just want to live on a tropical island and eat fruit. That's my dream.
I'm the same way. If I could eat fruit all day, I would. But unfortunately, my blood sugar would not allow for that.
Same.
What is your sun sign in astrology, if you know it?
Oh, of course. I'm a Leo.
Ooh,
speaking
me
of
too.
The sun sign. Same. Oh, cool. What's your birthday?
August 16th.
I'm August 6th.
Oh my gosh, how funny. Do you align with the Leo energy?
Well, my rising is Taurus, and I oscillate between those. It depends on the week or the day, but I see both of those in me for sure. The Leo, like I love the sun. I'm in the sun every day. And then the Taurus, I'm a total homebody. So I guess I have a bit of both. I align with both. Yeah.
I love that. Yeah, I'm the same way. I love the sun, and living in New York made me a little sad, not going to lie.
It's a real thing, right? S-A-D-D.
Yes, it is. What is one book that changed your life that you'd recommend to everyone?
It's funny because it's Michael Singer. I'm blanking on the name of the Surrender Experiment.
That is one of my favorite books ever.
Nice. Me too. I think, you know, there's a lot of books that came to mind when you said that, but I think In the spirit of the question, that would be the one that I'd recommend. And I recommend that to a lot of patients, Surrender Experiment by Michael A. Singer.
So good. What is one habit or ritual that you do every day that's a non-negotiable for you?
Oh my God. My whole life is routine and discipline. So there's a lot. Basically, like from the moment I wake up to the moment I go to bed, it's like disciplined routine. Oh, so which one should we pick? That's the question. Non-negotiable. Oh, kind of. We just talked about it. Laying in the sun, if I get the opportunity, and in LA, there's a lot of that. If it's a nice enough day and I have even 15 minutes, but preferably an hour, that's kind of a non-negotiable. I need the sun. Like being a sun sign, a Leo, being in LA, I really thrive with the sun, and I don't when I don't get the sun. So I'll say that.
I love that. No one's ever said that one before. And there's so many, I mean, we didn't get into this and maybe we'll have to do a part two, but with circadian biology and the sun and how it affects our hormones, like that could be a whole different podcast episode. But the last question for now, this podcast is called Loving Wellness. It actually recently went through a rebrand. So what does Loving Wellness mean to you?
Well, when I saw the name Loving Wellness, I thought of it as like, we love wellness, you know,
it goes both ways.
Yeah. And then the other is like providing wellness that is loving.
Right? Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So it's good. Cause it's like, you know, a double meaning there. Loving wellness. What does it mean to me? Loving wellness. I mean, the first definition I thought of when I read it was like, we love wellness, and I do love wellness because it makes me feel good. And people will ask me like how I can be so restrictive, quote unquote. I don't use that word. I don't think it's being restrictive. I think it's putting myself in position to be the best version of myself and feel optimal every day, because I've spent a lot of time in my life sick and unwell. And that's a suffering that I don't want. And I'm in control of it to a large degree, as most people are. And so if you can embrace wellness as something you love and provide yourself with loving wellness, then you can ascend in this life. You know, you can become a better version of yourself, a fuller expression of yourself. And you really don't even know what will come of that, where it will lead. Your life can unfold in ways you could never have dreamed of or expected. If you put your body in position to be nourished and thriving, it can really change your consciousness. So, you know, in terms of like spirituality, you really have to get the body prepared first if you want to ascend in a spiritual way and, you know, energetically balanced and all of that. So, yeah, I think it's like being in love with wellness and providing yourself loving wellness is really a sign of gratitude for your incarnation here as a being.
I absolutely love everything you just said. And to your point on the restriction and the discipline, I view all of that as a loving act to your body so that you can respect the vessel that you came in here, like you're saying, and that you incarnated in. So thank you for sharing. And I completely agree with so much of what you've said. And I'm so grateful for this conversation and getting to share this with people. I think, like I said before, it's really, really going to help a lot of people. So if people are interested in working with you and finding you online, following you, how can they do so?
Thank you. I have a website that people could start with. It's called peacefulmountainmedicine.com. And then I have an Instagram that I post on. If people are interested in checking out some of the things I write about or think, it's Dr. Ryan Monahan. That's the handle, DrRyanMonahan. But maybe just start at my website, peacefulmountainmedicine.com, and the Instagram is linked there too. So those are the two places I would say to start to kind of learn more.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Dr. Ryan.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you in the next one.